Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows.
A brief note before we start recording. I was texting back and forth with Mike and asking him about the book One with the Wilderness that we're reading from currently, and asked him if he had any more copies or if it was out of print. And he's working on a small run getting them reprinted. But in the meantime, he said that every order of Chasing Solitude DVD or Blu-ray sold during the rest of April would receive a free copy of Primal Dreams condensed version and be in the hat for a chance of drawing an autographed copy of One with the Wilderness. Orders must be placed through herdbullproductions.com to qualify, and the drawing will take place on May 6th. So if you haven't seen either of those, I highly recommend those two DVDs. And even the full version of Primal Dreams, man, pick up that in addition. But jump in there, support Mike, and get a copy of this in these two DVDs, because in these quarantine times, you need all the entertainment you can get. Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox. Today is a Mike Mitten read, One with the Wilderness. But before we dive into that, it's March 28th in coronavirus lockdown, and the wind is howling, the snow is flying, so it's a good day to be inside. We are, speaking of coronavirus, we have a stimulus package going here at Stalker that if you are interested in buying a new bow, whether it be a custom or a stock bow, or a set of ILF limbs, then or a set of limbs for your Coyote, Wolverine, Vortex, etc., then we have a coronavirus discount. So just in the checkout, or if you want to call in the order, just mention Corona and you get $100 off. So not a bad gig. Currently our new build time is about 3 to 4 weeks, depending on when this gets aired and where we're at in the order process. But I would say 3 to 4 weeks on new orders currently. So getting a pretty quick turnaround. There's plenty of time to get a new bow ordered and be able to hunt with it this fall as far as practicing. And even if you're converting from a compound, it should give you a sufficient amount of time. So we're on chapter one now, starting the good stuff here. This one is outdoor skills. In today's fast-paced society, there are many of us that long for a simpler time. A time of providing one's own sustenance from wild places through confidence and self-reliance. Our numbers have not diminished, but we are diluted in an increasing general population that is growing more urban. There was a time when there was no need to discuss woodsmanship because nearly everyone had it to some degree. It took me years to obtain the skills and confidence to go off on an extended bowhunting trip alone in the wilderness. This was not a conscious effort on my part. I didn't research it online or take a class. There was no outline, syllabus, or plan to obtain these skills, but like most of us, I acquired them without even really knowing it or realizing what they were. Being outside and engaging in all sorts of outdoor activities was just something we did as kids. I'm not sure if it's because of my Miami Indian heritage, but playing in the wooded ravine and creek near our home fostered an early desire for exploration and investigation in the natural world. Camping, canoeing, and fishing with my father, along with Boy Scouting, were important influences that nurtured my continued growth, skills, and knowledge. Practical application used in trapping, football, raccoon hunting, and bow hunting polished my skills and built confidence and developed the mental toughness I needed to comfortably meet the fears and challenges of solo hunting. I grew up with my four brothers and two sisters in one of the northernmost suburbs of Chicago, about halfway between Chicago and Milwaukee. Even in this urban environment, my instincts to hunt was strong, and my love for nature manifested itself early on. We caught many crayfish in the creek near our home and reared them in large coolers and tanks we kept along the side of our house. In our makeshift aquariums, we reconstructed a stream bed with sand, rocks, small logs, and sticks. There we would observe the daily habits of the crustaceans, feeding them earthworms, bologna, and bacon strips. In time, we would have many hundreds of baby crayfish. When we had to leave for summer vacation, we carried them down to the creek and released them back into their natural environment. We would also capture snakes, frogs, various fish, and pretty much do the same thing. We once held over 50 garter snakes in a horse tank. They would eat crickets and small frogs. Eventually, they would have babies too, and we learned that the eggs of the snakes are very thin and break as soon as they are discharged, giving up the impression that the baby snakes were live-birthed like mammals, when in reality the gestation takes place within the mother and each baby is secured within its own membrane, the eggshell. I was a Cub Scout and a Boy Scout, where I received the highest rank of Eagle. The scouting journey exposed me to more diversity of personal growth than anything else in my life. Not only did I begin to master my woodsmanship skills like fire building, canoeing, swimming, knot tying, first aid, and knife sharpening, but I also learned how many of the animals we saw and loved fit into the larger scheme of things. By earning merit badges, I was actually taking mini courses in conservation and natural resources, fish and wildlife management, soil and water conservation, environmental science, nature, weather, bird, reptile, and mammal studies. I understood that all life form depends on each other in the web of nature, and that air, soil, and water are the foundation for this close relationship. Conservation of these natural resources became more vital to us when we realized we were active participants. We humans tend to do more to protect something when it is part of us. That is how I came to feel about hunting. It is part of me. There is a tendency by urban Americans to want to set aside and kind of preserve nature in its natural state with a mindset of nature and wildlife is over there, so let's just sit back and look at it from over here. The problem is that man has had a significant effect on the natural world and the landscape of Earth. So setting nature aside as something of a historical artwork does not always do well, because nature is also dynamic and ever-changing. The imbalance caused by man can't always be repaired, but I think that there is much more likely to be a unified effort to correct mistakes if man feels included and connected to the natural world. If man is a consumer of fish and upland game, or migratory ungulates, for instance, I feel that a much stronger case will be made for prevention of water pollution, soil contamination, and chemical assault of our air by those who feel they are a part of the cycle of life, compared to those who just see nature as something pretty to look at over there. No matter how we measure it, our natural world must have some worth. First aid is really just common sense built on the principles of immediate temporary care. It's very simple to take care for minor abrasions and cuts, and it only takes a little time to prepare for them in advance. Band-aids, bandages, sterile gauze, tape, and antiseptic are easily obtained and carried with me when I hunt. There are many instances when our hunting or fishing where a little first aid will go a long way in preserving the integrity of your trip. The scout motto of be prepared cannot be stressed enough. Should the need arise while I'm alone, I would try to quickly stop the bleeding of a severe wound first before worrying about using something sterile. I can address the wound condition with help at a later time. Stopping the bleeding quickly would be priority one. Severe arterial bleeding is very serious for anyone, let alone a solo hunter. One of my first responses would be to apply direct pressure to the wound, elevate the injured limb, followed by restricting the artery between the wound and the heart. These pressure points can be found on the inside of the arm and legs and slow the blood's flow by pressing the artery flat against the bone with the tips of my fingers or the heel of my hand. To help maintain the pressure, a length of rope or tape or even the weight of an object like my backpack could work. I try to keep these items with me at all times. The use of a tourniquet is the last resort and should only be used in the most severe cases when all other efforts have failed. The use of a tourniquet is very dangerous and has a high chance to induce shock if used incorrectly. There is also an extremely high probability that the limb will be lost below the tourniquet. Nearly every accident brings shock, which is the rapid loss of strength caused by fear, pain, and sometimes of blood. Shock is deadly serious, and you shouldn't wait to begin treatment. Assume that shock will be present in all instances. For severe injuries of the head or troubled breathing, I was taught to lie down and raise the head and shoulders. If there is no head injury, raise the feet. I use rope or cords on every hunting trip to secure shelter or just haul my bow up into a tree, and the knots I use to tie them I learned through scouting. The three knots I use most are the square knot, double half hitch, and bowline. Of the three, the bowline is probably the most useful for me. It is the best knot for forming a non-slip loop on a rope. It's easy to untie even after a lot of pressure has been applied to the rope and knot. I use it on the tent tie-outs, winch cords used to lash items to my frame pack, and the pull-up line for my bow, clothesline, tie-down for my canoe, and many more. I would say that since the age of 8, I have spent at least a few days every year sleeping in a tent. Some years that number may have exceeded 3 months. I've experienced a wide range of conditions, everything from extremely warm temperatures exceeding 100 degrees Fahrenheit to those below zero, with every type of storm in between. I've learned to always use a waterproof ground cloth under the tent floor, and I always try to pitch my tent with the door facing east. Almost every storm comes out of the west or north in the northern hemisphere, so facing the weakest part of the tent, which is the door, towards the east provides the best resistance against the wind. I prefer lower, 4 to 5 feet high, dome-style tents because they provide a larger footprint while having fewer corners that can get caught by heavy winds. They also have shed water well and tend to sag less than A-frame styles. The dome styles I like usually have many D-rings or gussets to which to tie out lines. There are many diverse tent designs, materials, and framing. I have had good luck with tents that incorporate a rain fly in their design. They seem to be well vented, which caused reduced condensation as well as adding additional protection against the wind and rain. Using a compass and topographical map is a necessity during most of my hunting trips. I learned the basics of navigation through Boy Scouting. A compass is a simple tool, but I trust it the most. I have learned to strengthen that trust by carrying more than one. If I suspect a compass is not working properly, a second one may confirm the result. The needle of the compass will show magnetic north, and I learned to adjust to true north, map north, depending on what state I was in. For instance, my home state of Illinois has a magnetic declination of 3 degrees east, while Colorado has a 13 degree east declination. I used a permanent feature on the map, such as a north-south road or an east-west river, to set my bearings when I first arrive at my new location. Sure, I've gotten lost as a youth and on a few hunts, but I've always kept a cool head and relied on the compass to find my way. I've gotten off track. It was mostly due to using land features such as ridges or mountain washes as a guide instead of the compass. Getting turned around during times of darkness or ground fog can be dangerous if you are trying to find your shelter. I use a compass on wilderness hunts so much that I carry one in my pants pockets and two in my backpack to ensure that I'm never without one. In 1970, my parents bought an 80-acre piece of recreational property in north-central Wisconsin. The land had a river running through it, and it was located in the heart of the lower unit of the Chichiquam, I'm going to pass on this one, National Forest. This property allowed me to actually put into practice the principle of conservation and wildlife management that I learned about in Boy Scouts. Since this property had been an active dairy farm for decades, my father and I reforested portions of it by planting thousands of Norway spruce, along with red and white pine. I organized the planting and mobilized members of my Boy Scout troop to help. The first planting qualified for my activity project, which was required to advance to the rank of Life Scout. The goal of the reforesting project was to provide a windbreak and reduce soil erosions. As the trees matured, they would also supply shelter and food for wildlife. Birds made nests in the branches, and squirrels, mice, and birds can eat the pine cone seeds. The lower limbs can provide roughage to deer browse during stressful times of the year by helping them to maintain active bacterial cultures in their digestive tract. I said first planting because 3 years after we planted the trees, a harsh winter dumped multiple feet of snow. As more favorable food sources ran out, mice and snowshoe rabbits turned to the pines and spruce saplings to survive. Unfortunately for us, most of our hard work did not go as planned, and the spring thaw revealed thousands of dead, girdled trees. Notice I didn't say our work was wasted. Few things in nature go to waste. My father and I replanted the trees. It took more work, but we planted more than before, and I placed them closer together. Eventually, the trees took hold and outgrew the grasses, growing over a foot per year. As things turned out, 5 years later, I hid behind one of those trees as a group of deer fed from a clover field back into the stand of evergreens we planted. I saw them from across the river and snuck upstream, crossed and got to the back of the back corner of the field before the deer. I crouched motionless and blended into the spruce plantation. A big doe passed out of range, but her button buck trotted past as I drew and released. He didn't go far after being hit before lying down. That first deer was so special to me. I had the hide tanned and carried a piece of it along with me on many future hunts. I used parts of the hide as trim on my quivers, nice sheath, and hat band. It was also a special deer because the trees we planted were used as secure cover for the deer as they entered the field, but also provided me the structure to hide behind as I fooled their eyesight when they moved into my close quarters. I was never more connected to the web of life than when I took that first deer. The romance of taking a deer while hiding behind a tree I had planted returned to me 30 years later when I relived the encounter by telling my 15-year-old son about the story of my first deer while we were hanging a stand in one of those same trees. It mattered not that we didn't get any shots at deer that evening. We were in a sacred place on Grandpa's land where we were held aloft by a sturdy tree trunk that had once slipped through my fingers into a slit in the ground. I don't think I am any more driven than the next guy, but I do like to see things go to completion. If I climb a mountain, I don't usually quit until I reach the top. If new terrain means hiking 8 to 10 miles, I do it. When hiking or looking for shed antlers, I can walk all day if I have to. I don't think I train much for endurance. It's more of a mind thing that just keeps me going, and my body has to keep up. My first initiation to tough discipline was playing football for my coach, Keith Ryan. Mr. Ryan was a fair disciplinarian that demanded not only physical preparation but also mental toughness. My teammates and I had to memorize an offensive playbook not only for our own position but for another position on the team. We may never be used in that position during the season, but the mental exercise forced us to use our brains. We had two-a-day practices during preseason, and there were days that we had sleepovers as a team in the church basement to foster camaraderie and the feeling of unity. Practice and training focused on physical conditioning, but for some of my teammates, the mental test was the most difficult to achieve. Coach Ryan mandated that all players stand before him and individually recite the inspirational poem, The State of Mind, written by the late Vince Lombardi. The physical act of the memorization challenged the mind, while the words themselves describe the value of mental stamina and mind over matter. If you think you're beaten, you are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you'd like to win but think you can't, it's almost a cinch that you won't. If you think you'll lose, you've lost. Even this act of standing in front of coach with the rest of the team looking on stresses the nerves. Meeting the demands of Coach Ryan before the first game did not guarantee wins, but they did go a long way in making us the best individuals and team that we could be. Sure, we made mistakes, and to think about them a while at the same time built physical endurance by running laps as punishment. If I had to run alone because of a lack of concentration or a blown assignment, I always tried to show Coach that I couldn't be broken. One trip around the schoolyard was about 700 yards. I would pace myself throughout most of it, but as I approached where Coach Ryan was standing, I would increase my running and kind of blow by him at near sprint speed. I would continue running for the rest of the practice. Even as the rest of my teammates were picked up by their parents at the end of practices, I would still not stop running until it was only me and the coach left. Then he waved his arms and got into his car and drove away, leaving me to walk home. He never personally acknowledged my effort, but on championship game day, I was the go-to guy and caught the winning pass. The lessons learned from my early football days stayed with me all of my life, carrying over into my work and hunting activities. Even my first job at the local feed store, I could hear the words of Coach Ryan and Coach Lombardi while unloading 60 tons of fertilizer and 50-pound bags onto hand carts. I remembered, "First out in the world, you will find success. Success begins with a fellow's will. It's all in the state of mind." As youths, my brothers and I used Havaharts cage-style animal traps to live capture many species of mammals and birds around our neighborhood. We caught them to get a closer look at them and then just released them when they were captured. At first, we caught mostly squirrels and rabbits, but as our trap sizes increased, we caught larger animals like raccoons, possums, mink, and gray fox. We lost interest in catching the routine squirrel and chipmunks and knew that changing the bait to meat, we would have a better chance of catching the carnivorous species that were primarily nocturnal. I can still vividly remember getting up early in the morning with high expectations of checking the traps. It was kind of a competition between us to see who could catch the coolest animals. Fox, weasels, and red-headed woodpeckers ranked very high. During high school, I used the same experiment in anticipation of checking the live traps I developed as a youth to fuel the dedication and discipline of running a small trap line for fur bearers. I used steel traps to catch gray fox, red fox, and coyotes in dirt hold sets placed in cut hay fields or along the winter wheat. I preferred using the conibear trap that dispatched the animals instantly for raccoons, mink, muskrat, and beaver. I read books on trapping by S. Stanley Hawbaker and A.R. Harding and requested that our high school library carry the Fur Fish and Game magazine. I learned to cape and flesh and dry the animals' hides and prepare them for sale to the local fur buyer. For nearly 3 months out of the year, I was married to the trap line in sickness and in health. I still had to get up every day and check traps before school. I drove my father's international scout to the trap line in the morning and would have it back to him before he left for work. The trap line forced me to experience all sorts of weather conditions and prepare against the constant threat of hypothermia. There were many water hazards when dealing with freezing ice and streams and cattail swamps. Frequently flooding meant traps that were on the bank to be located and moved. It seemed like I was always wet with leaking gloves, hip boots, and chest waders. I learned to dress in layers that I could remove when I was exerting myself so I wouldn't get hot and sweaty. Mom always told us to wear our hats, and I often put on two or three stocking caps depending on how cold it got. Layering the hats clearly demonstrated to me the significance of heat loss through the top of my head. To this day, I continue to wear multiple hats while deer hunting from a tree stand, often joking that it's a three or four hat day based on the ambient temperatures. When trapping, I use strategy, preparedness, caution, patience, and familiarity with animal behavior to successfully catch many fur bearers. Even though I used scents and lures to bring the critters to my traps, the scents themselves lured me each day with curiosity and anticipation. What did I catch was always on my mind. Always hopeful for that silky fox, sleek mink, or robust raccoon, excitement renewed itself over and over again until each trap was checked. The drive that pulled me from trap set to trap set was the same exuberance that pulls me while bow hunting from mountain ridge to mountain ridge, or from one valley to the next in hopes of finding that special bull moose or herd of elk. It's looking for that same answer, what's around the next corner or over the next hill. But instead of just blind hope, I take a figurative peek by first using a topographical map or aerial photo. Like trapping, planning and preparedness comes first with the hunt, and then drive and enthusiasm for exploration ignites excitement. Much of the proceeds I learned from trapping furs and hunting raccoons with hounds were used to pay for my college education. I received a bachelor's degree in biology from Northern Illinois University, graduating in 1983. I kept a coonhound with me for several weeks during the fall. She slept during the day on the back seat of my car while I attended classes, but every night we hunted raccoons together on local farms of DeKalb County. Raising and training and treeing walker coonhounds is something I've enjoyed for decades. I bought my first hound in 1981 and have never been without them. Coon hunting is about the dogs, and training starts long before any raccoons are treed. Hunting at night really does test my sense of direction and reliance on my compass. There are many unseen hazards encountered at night, ditches, holes, overhanging branches, and swampy sinkholes being among them. Except for my dogs, I often coon hunted alone. The routine of self-reliance and confidence were starting to set in. The thing about raising raccoon hounds is that the training season lasts nearly all year long, but we are only allowed to harvest the coons during a few months during the fall and early winter. This dedication seems to fuel me. Coon hunting promoted endurance, as I had to go wherever the hounds would lead me. Quite often that meant hiking over hill and dale, through swamps and mature forests for 5 to 10 miles each night. During particularly successful night trips in the fall, I had to carry out over a half a dozen raccoon carcasses on an average. Large Northern Illinois raccoons can weigh 25 to 40 pounds each, getting me in good shape for bow hunting. During the mid-70s, I went on my first bow hunt for white-tailed deer. As kids, we were encouraged to practice shooting our bows at the backstop of our adult neighbor, Marvin Stride. I got pretty good at hitting the targets with the 35-pound pole bear tiger cat that I received from my father one Christmas. I eventually outgrew that bow. I bought a bear grizzly of stronger pull. So when the season opened, I went on my first deer hunt near Black River Falls, Wisconsin, with a friend, Carl Spath. We sat ground blinds near field edges during the morning and evenings, but during midday we stalked along in tandem through pine plantations and oak ridges in hopes of getting a shot at a deer or pushing them past the other partner in the event we spooked them. We had some close opportunities, but never took a deer. Later on, I hunted with two other friends, Kevin Gusticia and Tom King. Tom's father owned land near Friendship, Wisconsin, and we secured permission to bow hunt from elderly farmers in the area. We used a similar style of hunting in this area, but instead of ground blinds, we used climbing tree stands. I learned early on that stands set up next to the edge of a hayfield would produce more deer sightings, but once I figured out where the deer were coming from, I would change stand locations to a new position along a trail at least 50 yards from the field. Within the security of the shady timber, the deer appeared more relaxed. Usually does and fawns came out to feed first. Since we only hunted on weekends, it was all I could do to get anything done during the week at work or at college. My mind was full of deer. During an early morning hunt, Kevin and Tom dropped me off on the backside of a huge stand of timber while they drove the car around and made a slow push along a ridge towards me. My friends had both killed deer with rifles and were used to making small deer drives. While sitting there on a small folding stool against an oak tree on the top of the ridge, it wasn't long before I heard deer running toward me, and then I saw them with their ears upright and flagging tails as they bounded past me out of range. But then, bringing up the rear, there was a flash of horns, and a small buck showed himself and stopped to look back at the intruder. My bow was up, arrow nocked, but shaking hands had to be calmed before I could draw. Then suddenly, from behind the six-point, I saw a streak of more antlers going through the brush. A very stout buck with a thick 10-point frame was trying to sneak away from the partners, Tom and Kevin. Unaware that I had closed off his back door, as soon as the big buck reached the six-pointer, it broke to the right, sending the young buck directly past me. I barely noticed the six-pointer as it passed me at 10 yards. My focus was on the 10-pointer. Once the 10-pointer broke right, it dropped slightly down the hill, effectively shielding itself from any dangers at the ridge top. I couldn't help but note how different the big buck carried himself compared to the younger. The older buck did not jump high and flag its tail. Instead, he ran crouched down with his tail tucked and kind of zigzagged as it fled. I rotated toward the buck, then suddenly he stopped momentarily in an opening directly broadside. I quickly drew and shot, sending my arrow on a journey right over the buck's back, landing harmlessly in the ferns. The buck exploded in flight, and so did my heart. That first close encounter with a mature whitetail sent adrenaline coursing through my body, infecting me with a lifetime of whitetail fever. It mattered not that I'd missed the buck, because I got exposed to the essence of the hunt in its purest form. When my friends arrived, I performed another ritual of the hunt. I told the story of that morning's events. We were all very excited, and Kevin told me that this was much different than hunting with a firearm. If I had missed with a gun at that range, I would have been ridiculed to no end. But when hunting with a bow, all close encounters are special and live much longer through stories and fireside tales, no matter the outcome. My passion for bow hunting whitetail is the same today as it was when I first started hunting them. Hunting mature bucks took on a new purpose in my life. Seemingly, everything I did was geared for that brief encounter in the fall. Spring was consumed with scouting and shed antler hunting. Those sheds told of living bucks, fueling imagination and hope for the fall. Multiple years of the same buck's sheds allowed me to share in that animal's life, even though some of them I may never have seen. The special connection kept the spunk alive in me through the tough times when weather, wind, and stand selections didn't go my way. I didn't use set cameras back then, so the shed antlers became a most valued learning tool. The locations where they were found told of the deer's movements and a glimpse of the buck's preferred cover. Even though the place where the shed was found is just a snapshot in the deer's life, I can't help but feel its presence. The feeling is more intense when the shed was from a buck I had encountered during the season. Maybe I had passed it up, or it had eluded me outright. Sheds are real and can be measured, held, touched, smelled, bridging a fantasy to reality. By the time summer rolls around, the whitetail bucks tend to hang out in bachelor groups, and the challenge now is trying to relocate them. Agricultural fields in the Midwest can really draw in deer, especially soybeans or hay fields of clover or alfalfa. June and early July are good times to try and locate the deer because they tend to be more visible much earlier in the evening. I've seen mature bucks come out as early as 5 p.m. when twilight doesn't occur until 9 p.m. The bucks come out this early to feed only for a short time, but they often have youthfulness about them, running and jumping through the hay or soybeans. This may be releasing frustration from flies and bugs that are momentarily escaping from. Even though their antlers are nowhere near their full development, early to midsummer scouting may be the only times I get a chance to see some of these more secretive bucks. As their racks grow, they become harder to see and film, often showing up to feed right at dark. Expectations for the season may be high at the end of August, but as soon as the bucks come out of velvet in September, the bachelors split up for their parts that are quite often unknown. I hope that these special moments witnessed in the summer will return to me at a later date, and perhaps timing, maturity, and the proper shot placement will combine with the taking of a prized buck. Hunting mature whitetail bucks developed into an isolation for my brothers, our friends, and me. By that, I mean that the pursuit of trophy bucks caused us to find our own places to hunt, enduring less overall disturbance and giving each of us our sense of achievement and accomplishment of doing it ourselves. We never really viewed trophy hunting as a bad thing. For us, trying to outwit a big buck was just another way to extend the season. After all, the hunt was the main thing we were attracted to, and filling a tag early on a young deer would end that. During the late 1980s, our home state of Illinois offered two buck tags for resident hunters. Some years I would be lucky enough to fill both tags, while other seasons would go with no bucks being taken at all. To me, there is no greater respect given to a prey animal than giving it at least the opportunity to have a full life. I've taken this philosophy with me all over the West and Alaska by passing up legal opportunities on nearly every hunt I've been on. That's not saying I've taken mature animals on every hunt, but by being selective, I'm assured a fulfilled hunt, which is of utmost importance to me. I don't let anything cheat me out of experiencing a real hunt. The definition of a real hunt may vary between hunters, but for me, there must be a challenge, risk of failure, and respect for my quarry. Woodsmanship and learning outdoor lore comes into many different forms, including our own personal beliefs and ethics. They can only be developed through actual experiences, personal exploration, and growth. Therein lies the fun. Some things just can't be bought, but must be lived. In the remaining chapters of this section, I will tell other stories of my growth towards self-reliance in the field and continue a journey with friends who cherish in our lives intertwined with nature throughout the hunt. That ends chapter one. If you are able to pick up a copy of this book, it's worth it just for looking at the pictures. There's a lot of great photography that accompanies this. And as we work our way kind of chronologically through Mike's life here, he expands from hunting whitetails to going out west and hunting elk and mule deer, and then up to Alaska for bear and moose and such. So a lot more adventures to come besides just a whitetail hunting and the talk of predators and trapping and such. All right, thanks for tuning in, and we'll be catching up again here shortly.
If you have a question, topic, or guest that you'd like to hear about, log on to iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Rate the podcast, and in the review, leave your question, topic, or guest suggestion. Any questions posted will be answered at the beginning of the next recorded podcast. Topics and guest suggestions will be considered and pursued. Additionally, the rating will help the podcast grow. You can further support the podcast by logging on to the Stalker Stickbows website and purchasing a Western Bowhunter Podcast t-shirt or window sticker from the Stalker store. Thanks for your support. I've gone down.